Chapter 10. A Pride Comes to Ultramar. Enter every city as though you are its firstborn master. Fulgrim, Primarch of the Third Legion. The six great war horns of the ancient battle kings sounded across the storm-lit Civitas, screeching out long, rasping blasts in unison. The horns, hollowed from the tusks of an extinct beast, had once been wheeled into battle on giant cart engines in the vanguards of the armies that Conor and his forebears had taken to war. Now they were placed in the minarets of fortified towers around Marshall Square and the great wall of the fortress. As their hoarse bellows died away like the fading roars of a monstrous bull or glacial pachyderm receding into myth, the sharper fanfare of the 13th began, silver trumpets and carnix, 800 of each, swelling with bright, triumphal joy. In full magisterial war gear, like a golden and azure demigod, Gilliman stood on the platform of the colossal Propylae Titanicus, the Titan's Gate that formed the northern entrance of Marshall Square. It was a pylon gate, large enough for even the largest engines of the Collegia Titanica to pass beneath without stooping, a fact that had been demonstrated twice that morning. Titan's Gate had been draped with the colours of the 13th Legion for the occasion, flanked on either side by the drop banners of the Titan Legions, various army regiments, along with the standards of the 5th, 6th, 7th, 10th, 18th and 19th Legiones Astartes. Gilliman breathed in, ignoring the dull wound ache in his back and the cramp of his healing lungs. From his vantage overlooking the 900-hectare square, paved in polished azurite and marble from the quarries of Kalut, he could see the Avenue of Heroes, the central axis of the Civitas. Its pavements, only 1,000th part engraved with the names of the fallen, led due north to the massive glacis of the Aegis Wall that surrounded the castrum. Above that majestic, cliff-like rampart rose the implacable towers and halls of the Fortress of Hera, dwarfing the Residency, the Agesilaus Barracks, and the High Senate, each one a vast building in its own right, but which clustered like small children in the skirts of the Legion Fortress. The fortress and its surrounding structures on the high castrum were collectively known as the Palaeopolis, or Old City. Behind that vista, stabbing into the sky, climbed the distant mountains, the points of Hera's crown, usually ghost blue at that time of year, but now a submarine green, thanks to the stormlight. To the east of the square lay the imposing domes of the new Senate House and the Deribitorium, the municipal buildings that dominated Circe Deme, a district of habitas and industry which ran east across the valley to the Porta Meads and the fine farming country beyond, where many consuls kept their estates. Circe and its neighbouring demes were collectively known as the Neapolis, the new city. To the west lay the river Laponis, shining like smoked glass in the daylight, which wound between the vast black ziggurat castle of the Mechanicum and the vertiginous red basilica of the Astra Telepathica. No birds ever flew in that part of the sky. This was a fact that Gilliman had noted from the moment the basilica was first raised and inhabited. To the southwest of Marshall Square lay the geographic centre of Magna Macrag Civitas, the point at which the north-south running Cardo of the Via Laponis crossed the east-west running Via Decumanus Maximus. The spot was marked at a circular intersection guarded by herms and blackwork statues, by the Milion, a milestone marker from which all measurements in the Civitas and, technically, the entire realm of Ultramar were measured. It was from the top of that milestone, his hands red with traitor blood, that Gilliman had made his first rallying speech during Galen's revolt, the uprising that had left his beloved stepfather dead. Due south of where he stood, the grand colonnade led straight and true from the south end of the square all the way down to the starport fields and the coast. The airspace had been cleared. Gilliman could smell the sea and even glimpse the distant glitter of its racing waves. It was nearly time. The intensity of the trumpet fanfare shivered the air, but he knew it would soon be drowned out by the roar of braking jets and landing thrusters. Gilliman felt a kind of gladness. The arrival of his warlord brother threw up many questions and troubles, but it at least marked a state change in the affairs of Ultramar. Whatever else it might be, this was a turning point. It was also an excuse to take pride in the glory of Macragge and the 13th. It had been a long time since his legion had assembled in full and formal regalia for the sheer magnificence of it. Nothing since Calth, not even the hard-fought victories and bloody feats of retribution, had caused them to celebrate. The arrival of the Lion called for nothing less. The galaxy contained only 18 Primarchs. The conjunction of even two of them was a singular moment when the balance of the cosmos was temporarily and specifically weighted, especially when those two were, perhaps, the most fated and respected war leaders of all. This was a day to be marked, so that all of Macragge, all of Ultramar, knew it. This was a moment. The Lord of the Dark Angels deserved such respect, and by the high towers of terror, Gilliman knew his warriors deserved to feel pride, too. Gilliman was accompanied on the platform by Gorod and the Invictus Guard, by Augustine and 15 officers of the 13th's senior ranks, by 94 senior army and fleet commanders, by high officers of the Senate and the Mechanicum, and by 20 centurion-ranked warriors of the Legiones Astartes, representing an officer cadre for the other legions that had come to Macragge. Of high officers of the 13th present on Macragge that day, only Valentus Dolor was noticeable by his absence. The first fanfare of the trumpets had ended. As the second volleying blast began, the clean silver notes of the horns lofting like a flock of bright eagles into the summer sky, the war horns of the Collegia Titanica began to boom in harmony. 40 war engines, representing all 8 of the Titan legions pacted with Gilliman, the engine forces of the Forge Worlds, Tigris and Acatran, stood on station around Marshall Square, or flanked the Grand Colonnade to the starport gates. The assembly included 9 warlords and 2 Imperator engines, the Ajax Iastus and the Death Casts Its Own Long Shadow, which had taken up positions on either side of the platform and stood like vertical cities bristling with guns. The air did more than shiver. It threatened to split. Gilliman allowed himself a smile. He glanced to his side and saw Yuton grimacing and covering her ears. He beheld the scene again. This was his empire. It was magnificent. He would never use the phrase his empire out loud, of course, but it was. He had founded it and fought for it, and he knew that one day he would die for it too. Below him, the polished marble paving slabs of Marshall Square gleamed in the stormlight and the eerie luminosity of the Pharos, the single star in the sky. Around the vast square lay the Magna Macragge Civitas, one of the greatest cities of the Imperium. It wasn't the city that mattered. It was what the city bred. It was what the city could produce. Gilliman had assembled an honour guard of 9,000 ultramarines around the edges of the square. They stood in perfectly mediated blocks behind their respective company standards, their polished war gear glittering in the daylight. Between each company formation was assembled either a mechanized armor formation or an army battalion, the soldiers kneeling in obeisance beneath their fluttering vexils held aloft by their bannermen. Gilliman was offering his brother an honor guard of almost 47,000 fighting souls, not to mention the million or more civilians crowded into the adjacent streets and thoroughfares for a glimpse of the Lion Lord and his famous warriors. Yuton had told Gilliman that street hawkers and vendors were doing a brisk trade in cheap icons and tin badges, displaying the iconography of the First Legion. "So my people think he will save them when I cannot," Gilliman had asked as he strapped on his ceremonial plate in the residence's fitting chamber. Yuton had blown a raspberry. They celebrate the moment, you foolish boy, she replied. They welcome his arrival. He is noble and he is loyal. Gilliman had nodded. Are you jealous of him? Yuton had asked.
No.
You are. You are, because he is the lord of the firstborn. I never thought I would see such jealousy in you, my dear lord. It does not become you. But it is also rather sweet.
Gilliman had growled something indecipherable, and then demanded that his armourers adjust the servo fit of his pauldrons.
Of course, Yuton had added thoughtfully, he is lord of the first, and thus the first of your equals, but he was not the first found.
What, woman?
Horus was the first lost son to be found. Look how well that ended, my lord.
Gilliman had looked at her and laughed. He couldn't stop himself. It had felt good.
First is not always best, Yuton had said, also laughing. My eighth found lord of the 13th Legion. Look who has an empire.
Still smiling, Gilliman had looked at her.
Be careful what you say, he had told her. Whatever I have, my beloved brother Horus almost has an empire.
The point is, she had replied, the people of Macragge know that two primarchs are logically better than one.
The trumpet screamed, lifting him from the memory. An aide stepped to Gilliman's side and presented him with a gene reader data slate.
Your authority to open airspace, my lord, the aide bowed.
Given, Gilliman said.
He took the slate and kissed the screen. Such ultimate authorities required a direct gene sample, and it was often too cumbersome for a fully plated warrior to remove a power fist or gauntlet to effect a dermal read. A kiss had become the expedient and understood custom. Gilliman knew that some, like First Master Freitas Augustan, preferred to spit on slates rather than kiss them. It had the same effect, but it lacked humility. The deep systems of the Civitas accepted and interpreted his genetic order. Overhead, the starport airspace opened and the void shields slid aside. Ships descended from the shadow of a fleet lying out in the atmospheric murk. First, stormbirds, painted void black, the leading edges of their wings flecked in dark, dark green, the colour of ancient forests. Behind them, in formation, landing ships, Thunderhawks and Thunderhawk bulkers and troop landers. They were not just in formation. They descended in perfect, perfect aerial synchronicity. The ships came down like formation dancers in a precisely integrated and orchestrated ballet.
He's showing off, Gilliman thought. He smiled. I would too, if the situation was reversed.
The ships began to land, four by four, in perfect sequence, along the top of the colonnade where it met Marshall Square. The timing of their touchdowns was almost embarrassingly precise. Four, then four, then four, each group together. Their downdraft obliterated the trumpet fanfare and even the constant howl of the Titan war engines. Drop hatches and ramps opened and released with similarly pin-sharp timing. Formations of dark angels strode down the ramps onto the colonnade and entered the square. They stepped as one, each beat perfect, each warrior gleaming and uniform. As the marching companies entered the square, they began to spread into wide, double ranks from their 10 by 10 blocks. The spread was seamless. Squads widened and melted into and through each other, forming a perfect double wall, all still marching in step, never missing a beat. The drill discipline was the most impressive Gilliman had ever seen.
He's showing off, he thought again.
Not missing a beat, the Dark Angel's formation rotated its edges to form a horseshoe with the open end facing the platform of Titan's Gate. 2,000 warriors deployed in sublimely orchestrated marching order. Then they began their weapons drill, all marching on the spot as they tossed, spun, and rotated their bolters, or threw swords and standards aloft and back again in precise returns. Beat, 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 beat. Gilliman noticed details of particular weapons carried by the Dark Angels, beam and projectile weapons of various kinds that even he did not immediately recognize. The First Legion had arsenals containing devices unknown to all the other legions. The Dark Angels had been the first created, and their history predated all other institutions of the Legiones Astartes. They were, in many regards, the prototype. It was said that during the latter years of the Unification War, and the first years of the Great Crusade, before the other legions had been constructed, the Dark Angels had known and done things that no other legion was privy to. They had built their strengths and identity in that era, in isolation. That identity had needed to be complete. When there was only one legion, that legion had been obliged to contain all specialisms. Gilliman knew that the six hosts, or wings, of the Dark Angels represented specialisms of every school, at subtle variance to the standard order of the Principia Bellicosa. Gilliman had also heard tell of secret orders and mysterious hierarchies within the ranks of the Dark Angels, hierarchies of knowledge, trust, and authority invisible to outsiders. It explained some of their curious insignia, which sometimes bore no relation to rank or company structure. Like their lord, the warriors of the First Legion were coded, shrouded, and ciphered. They kept secrets well. Perhaps too well. This was a legacy, Gilliman believed, of the formative days when they were alone and had no other legion to rely on. Without any sign of a signal, the Dark Angels suddenly stopped their drill and froze as one singular form. Perfect. Perfect. He's really showing off, Gilliman thought. His helm vox beeped. Gilliman looked at the mantle display. The ident tag read, Dolo. I'm busy, he said.
Of course you are, Lord, Dolor replied over the link. I would not trouble you if it wasn't important. I need to show you something.
Again, dear friend, this is not the time.
Agreed. Come to me as soon as you can, but do not pact anything with your noble brother that you can't undo until you have seen what I have to show you.
You unsettle me, Valentus.
Greet your brother. Commit to nothing. I have a practical here that you need to appreciate.
The link cut.
Everything all right? Yutun asked him.
Gilliman nodded.
They're very, very good at that marching drill thing, aren't they? Yutun said, gesturing at the square below.
The Dark Angels' ranks had begun moving again. They had peeled meticulously into tempered marching cohorts that crossed diagonally through other cohorts to create perfect new shapes, diamonds, squares, triangles, curved lines, a six-pointed star. Point leaders were turning and marching back into their packs, inverting the march order. It was annoyingly impressive.
I imagine they must get plenty of time to practice, Gilliman replied.
Yutun looked at him and covered her mouth with her hand.
"That's the most acid thing I've ever heard you say, Rabute," she declared.
He grinned at her.
"Brace yourself, ma'am. My big brother's come to stay. The acid is only just starting to flow."
Down below, on the polished marble stage of the Marshall Square, the Dark Angels finally finished their display. Polished bolters clamped to their chests, they formed a V-shaped fan of squads leading back to the ramp of the lead Stormbird. The lion emerged. Despite himself, Gilliman felt his heart skip and his lungs pump. The lion. The lion. There were brothers that he could look down on and was happy to, and there were brothers that he could admire. Rogel, Magnus and Sanguinius, and, damn him, even Russ. He could admire them for what they were, but there were only two brothers that he had ever actually looked up to. Only two brothers that he had ever actually admired. There were only two brothers that he felt shadowed by when they were present. Lion L. Johnson and Horace Lupercal. The lion emerged from his lander, stony-faced, bare-headed, his long golden hair trailing in the wind. So beautiful, so deadly, so empty, so unreadable. He carried his war helm under his left arm and marched with the same perfect discipline that his men displayed. To each side of him came his voted lieutenants in identical step. Beloved Corswain was commanding the First Legion elements on the other side of the ruin storm, so the lion was braced by Holguin and Farith Redloss. Holguin carried an executioner's long sword upright before him in his two hands, the tip of the 6-foot blade rounded over like a butter knife. His pauldron was marked with the crossed swords of the Deathwing. Redloss carried a massive war axe, haftwise, across his chest. His pauldron bore the skull in hourglass of the Dreadwing. All three wore black artificer armour worked with red Martian gold. They approached along the echelon, entering the square. Gilliman sighed. "Bastard, always showing off," he murmured. He looked at his aides, nodded, and began to walk down the steps to meet his brother. The wolves followed him. Gilliman stopped and looked back up the steps. "Really? Right now, of all times?" Gilliman asked Fafner.
"My watch pack walks where you walk, Jarl," said Fafner.
"Even my own cataphracti aren't following me at this moment, Wolf."
"We could, Lord," Gorod growled from the platform. "Indeed, we could also hose the unwanted off the steps in an unbelievable storm of shot, if you so desired."
"Enough," Gilliman said. He looked at Fafner and the wolves. "You see how I spare your lives."
"No one spares our lives, Jarl," Fafner replied. "They're not for sparing. Never have been."
"With respect," Biter Herrick whispered to his pack leader.
"Obviously, obviously. Like Biter, he says, goes without saying. With respect."
Gilliman hesitated, painfully aware that he was halfway down a staircase in front of 1.5 million people, pausing to converse with a band of barbarians while his noble brother waited below.
"I appeal to your honesty, Fafner Bloodbroder," he said. "This moment isn't about me, is it? It's about you and the angels and the feud."
Fafner paused.
"It is," he replied, nodding.
His men, hunched and ugly, nodded too. Gilliman sighed.
"Let's do it, then, but do not embarrass me or I'll gut you all myself."
He turned and resumed his walk down the steps from the platform. He was aware of the wolves closing in behind him as a ragged and unseemly bodyguard.
"By the void," Gilliman hissed at them, "you know you're making me look like an idiot, like a heathen king of Illyrium."
"Sorry and all that, Jarl. Honour demands it," Fafner replied, a hot breath whisper at Gilliman's shoulder.
"You're a pain in the arse, you know that," Gilliman said.
"Indisputably," Fafner returned.
Gilliman walked down to meet the lion. The lion walked up to meet him. It was a long wait. The distance between the landing site and the gate was over 1 kilometre. The two primarchs made slow progress towards one another. When they were at last face to face, there was a moment of silence. All the grand fanfares had died away. Even the crowd noise had ebbed. The lion looked at Gilliman. The avenging sun looked at the lion. The lion's black armour was richly engraved and inlaid with red gold. The chest plate and pauldrons displayed all the interconnected icons and symbols of his legion, the complex heraldry of the Dark Angels' hierarchies, visible and invisible. All the secret hosts, thrones and powers of the First Legion's secret structure were represented there, united by the central insignia, the six-pointed hexagrammaton. He wore the pelt of a forest beast across his right shoulder and the golden badge of a shrouded urn at his throat.
"Brother," said the lion.
"Brother," Gilliman replied.
"Well met."
"Not before time," said Gilliman.
"You do me a great honour with this show of force," the lion said, gently indicating the square around them.
"And you do me an honour with this display of drill," Gilliman said.
The lion smiled, nodding appreciative. He handed his war helm back to Holguin.
"Has it really been so long, Robute?" he asked, and abruptly embraced Gilliman in a clash of armour.
"No, no," Gilliman replied, swallowing hard. His war helm had been knocked out of his grip with the abruptness of the lion's embrace, and was rolling on the marble paving behind him.
"It's good to see you," he said, forcing control of his voice.
The lion broke the embrace and nodded. He bowed, picked up Gilliman's fallen helm, and rose again, handing it back to him.
"Good to see you too, brother," he said, "and good to see your extraordinary light. You must tell me all about that."
"I will, but there is another more immediate matter," Gilliman said, hoping his composure had remained intact.
"Of protocol," he added.
"The wolves," replied the lion.
"Just so," said Gilliman.
The lion nodded and turned away from Gilliman. He looked down at Fafner Bloodbroder.
"Name yourself, wolf. Let's get this done."
"I am Fafner, dear lord."
"Are you of Sesk? I recognize the markings."
"I am, lord."
"Let's take the smack, Fafner. Will it come from you?"
Fafner Bloodbroder straightened to his full height. The feud between the angels and the wolves had existed since Dulan. It was a ritual for them to field champions every time they met.
"Yes, lord," Fafner said. "I crave you advance your champion."
Both Holguin and Redlaw stepped forward.
"I'll be my own champion," the lion whispered. There was a hint of a smile on his lips.
"No," said Fafner.
"So the wolves of the rout are cowards, I take it."
"No," snarled Fafner.
"Then take your strike, wolf," said the lion, "and make it count."
Fafner sighed and swung his axe at the lion. Gilliman flinched as the blade cut the air beside him. It was a sensationally good strike. Fafner had betrayed no cues, no hint of muscle tension, no focus of powered plate. The blow had just come. Gilliman wondered if it would have taken him by surprise. He was forced to admit that it might have. The lion caught Fafner's swing with one hand, blocking the haft with the blade edge millimetres from his face. Fafner grunted involuntarily as his strength was met and fundamentally matched by superior power. Then the lion delivered his return blow. It came with his left hand, not enough to maim or kill, almost pulled, but fast, faster than Fafner's superb swing. It knocked the pack leader onto his knees and left the lion holding Fafner's axe. Fafner Bloodbroder rose to his feet again.
"Satisfied?" asked the lion, tossing the axe back to him.
"Honour is satisfied, lord,"
Fafner assented, catching it. He nodded and backed off, waving to his pack to do the same. Holguin and Redlaw both grinned with unbearable insouciance.
"Then tell Beau Sorin to guard his manners, Fafner," Gilliman said over his shoulder without looking back.
"I will, Jarl," Fafner returned.
Gilliman heard a hard slap and a muffled curse. He looked at the lion. He'd never realized before that the lion was very slightly taller than him.
"Shall we, brother?" he asked.
"The famous fortress of Hera," asked the lion. "I would be disappointed not to see it."
It was late afternoon. At the Occident Gate in the mighty Servian Wall, at the very western edge of Magna Macrag Civitas, the gate guards were processing incomers. There was a steady tide, tricksters and black marts flowing in to the evening markets of Laponis Deem from the slums of the Illyrian enclave behind the high wall, or agrics flocking to the city granaries with sweating payloads of grain from the Cora on bulk servitor wagons.
"Name?" asked the gate officer, a senior-ranked man in the precentral division. The man looked important, and he bloody knew it, too.
"Damon," replied Damon Prytanis, huddled on the back gate of a servitor freight car in his smelly black fur coat.
"What's going on?"
"What do you mean, what's going on?"
"In the city, all that air show, the damned horns."
"The First Legion has come to us," the officer replied proudly.
"The First Legion, eh? The Lion's Mob. Big news."
"It is,"
the officer agreed.
"Big news," Damon repeated, nodding.
His heart sank. Too many serious players for comfort.
"I don't," the officer reminded him.
Damon shrugged and nodded and held out his open, empty hand. It generally worked. The gesture was so automatic, guards usually saw what they wanted to see.
"Good, all right," the officer said, waving him on.
Damon passed through the deep, cold shade of the Occident Gate on the back of the jolting servitor car and entered the western edge of the city. This was his target city, his bloody destiny, probably. It was not promising. Down at this skunk end of the low-qual deem, it was still gross. Cheap-built habitats, tinker marts and slum runs, and would be for many kilometres before a traveller could reach the handsome domey and wide estates of Xanthi Deem in the low, rolling country west of the river. Damon dropped off the back of the trundling bulk car and started walking down the busy highway, skirting Illyrian caravans and grain cargoes. He suddenly had a bad feeling. He liked to call it his first sense, because, according to his blessed mother, he had not been born with any.
"Hey!" a voice called out from behind him. "Hey, you! Fur coat man!"
Damon cursed. The gate officer had only been temporarily convinced. Damon took a look back and saw a squad of precentals moving from the gatehouse in his direction. They were picking up pace and shoving slower-moving pedestrians out of their path. Most of the locals shrank back. The precentals looked like over-groomed show guards, but they were tough, well-trained, and they carried serious authority. They were also well-armed. Damon saw plasma weapons and intimidating blades.
"Halt!" one of them shouted. When Damon didn't, the officer started barking at the pedestrian traffic. "Out of the way! Give us a clear shot!"
A clear shot? Encouraging, welcoming, reassuring. Times were worse and tensions far hotter than he had anticipated, and he had anticipated a fair bit. It was a moment to switch out, to revert to the skills he'd honed hunting and being hunted over an unimaginably long period. The hindbrain temptation was huge. There were only a handful of humans in the galaxy possessed of equal to or greater experiential skills than Damon Prytanis. He'd met two of them, and one of those was his current target. The other was a surly, uncooperative rogue. Yet another of his kind was the Emperor of Man. Damon had never met the fellow and didn't much want to. He sounded like a total dunkhole. Smiling, he reverted. Damon ducked to his left very sharply, racing down an alley into the warren of Stenopoi, the maze of narrow streets in this most densely packed quarter of Laponis Deem. He collided with no one and knocked over nothing. People just got out of his way, or, if they froze, he went around them. He made two more turns, another left and then a hard right, following a dank, high-walled lane under the arches of a major aqueduct. Washing had been strung out to dry on lines below the arch and between the walls, and he could smell cookpots and pipe smoke. The guards were fit and close behind him, moving fast and with determination, despite the encumbrance of their armour and war gear.
He saw the hazy grey shapes of the giant granaries ahead of him, and thought for a moment that he might reach them and hide. But the precentals were efficient. A second squad had appeared, crossing a chain-dropped canal bridge ahead of him, to work back through the Stenopoi and pin him between them and his pursuers. He realised he was going to have to get wet. It disappointed him to have to contemplate blood business so early on, but it also partly pleased him. He'd been in the mountains for too long, and he was cold and hungry and fit to hurt someone. He'd been sent to Macragg to perform a mission he didn't want to perform, and challenge a man he didn't think needed to be challenged. Damon Prytanis was in an ugly mood, and by cornering him, the precentals had offered him a chance to vent that frustration. He carried four weapons. They had come with him in a sack of living flesh in order to survive as metallic items the extremity of the Fastjack teleport. The sack had been bred for purpose in the Ku-Nib replicator vat. Once he had cut it open and killed it to get at his weapons and kit after his painful arrival, its meat had fed him for 6 days. Four weapons. A matched brace of Zulkund Murek, elegant, long-snouted, knob-gripped sling pistols, the best kind. Eldar shuriken weapons were Damon's favoured firearms, for what they lacked in range and accuracy, they more than made up for in rate of fire and penetrative effect. This pair had come from Slough Dar's personal battle casket, an uncharacteristic gesture of generosity that had been made, Damon was sure, to emphasise the importance of the mission. One was called, in High Idharain, Guhru, which meant bleed to death, and the other was called, in the demotic and corrupted slang of the crone worlds, Mech Menite, which meant death looks in your eyes and finds you entirely wanting. He kept them holstered under his fur jacket in a makeshift double shoulder rig he'd made from the indigestible skin of the flesh sack. The third weapon was a short pattern chainsword, not much longer than a gladius, which dated from the interminable wars of the pre-unification era of Terra, and which had been designed as a secondary close protection weapon for the retinues of a pan-Pacific nobleman called Kendra Hul. The sword came from Damon's private collection, and he knew its provenance well because he'd been the retinue member it had been carried by, and he had given it its name, Hul's Doom. He wore it across his spine, once again under his heavy fur jacket. The fourth weapon was a small red glass bottle that lay in the right-hand pocket of his fur coat, jumbled in among the other odds and ends of his trade. Damon sidestepped into a range of shadows, darted under the eaves of an old stable block, and pulled himself back against a stone partition wall to wait. Six men coming from behind, six more from up ahead. Precentals all. All of them were packing plasma weapons and wielding quality blades if it got nasty close. Blades they knew how to handle. They were armoured in the head, torso, shoulders, groin and legs. Gilliman did not stint on the materiel budget for his householders, so that armour was plasteel at the very least, probably with a ceramite underveil. Nothing a Murek couldn't puncture, but he'd need to let them get very close to ensure hard, wet kills. He reached under his coat and drew his pistols, Guhru in his right hand and Mech Menite in his left. He held them up, muzzles aimed at the storm-streaked sky. With his thumbs, he stroked the studs that activated the almost silent gravitic accelerators and brought them cycling up to power. The wraithbone grips began to feel warm. The sound of racing footfalls had ceased. Damon listened and heard, over the gurgle of the nearby canal and the distant street sounds, a terse, hushed back and forth, vox chirps, a search pattern intersignalling as it spread out. "Come for me, then," he willed them. The first two appeared to his left, very suddenly, turning around the end of the stable block with their plasma weapons aimed. Snap! He was already moving. They had the drop, but he beat them to it. His guns came down, side by side, as he moved and fired. He squeezed each trigger with the lightest of touches, a pulse technique that the Eldar called the Iliad Fan, or Feather Finger. Shuriken technology was amazing. The gravitic accelerators shoved shots out of the weapons at abnormal velocities, and ammunition was a solid core block of plastic crystal that the guns sliced off and hurled one monomolecular disc at a time. It was so efficient a system that a single overgenerous squeeze of the trigger could unleash hundreds of razor rounds in a second or two. The Iliad Than technique allowed the shooter to fire off crisp bursts of 5 or 6 discs at a time, preserving the solid ammunition core and avoiding messy overkill. Damon was well practiced. Gu Hru spat 4 monomolecular discs through the armoured chest of one guard, and Mech Menite did the same to the other. Dark slits, suddenly welling blood in extravagant quantity, appeared in their chest plating as they fell backwards. One dropped onto the path, the other toppled over a rail into the dirty canal. Damon swung round as a third precentral appeared around the opposite end of the stable block behind him. Turning, he fired Gu Hru straight-armed and put 2 discs into the man's face, which ruptured messily inside the frame of his helmet. The man dropped to his knees, then flopped onto his front, kicking a squish of blood up out of his head on impact. No pausing now. Voices were raised. The men had heard the distinctive shriek of sling guns, a sound no being who had faced the Eldar ever forgot. Damon ran towards his first kills. The corpse in the water was face down and slowly sinking into the green, algae-thickened murk, supported by the air caught in his cape. The man on the path was on his back, his eyes as wide as full moons, blood leaking out of him in astonishing quantities, turning the earth pathway into terracotta putty. Damon knelt and made an adjustment to the man's weapon. Then he started to run back the way he had come. "Here he is! Help me!" he yelled over his shoulder as he ran. Damon threw himself sideways into the far end of the stable block, putting a heavy wall between him and the canal. He heard other precentals approaching, heard their outraged curses as they saw the kills. Then one of them said, "Wait, wait, what's that sound?" "A plasma weapon's power cell on overload, you numwit," Damon thought. It went off like a bomb, blowing out the far end of the stable block where it overhung the canal. Damon emerged into the smoke, finished off the one man the blast hadn't killed with a swift headshot, and counted the other bodies. It was a jigsaw. He had to make sense of the bloody half-cooked chunks. 4, 2 more still close then, and more squads would be on their way. How many more would he risk? How many more would it take to slake his frustration? He looked down at the canal. The water was very still suddenly. "Oh, come on," he began. Gahet looked up at him, an impossible reflection. The telepathic consult was like a hot wire through his brain.
"You waste time and expose your presence unnecessarily, Damon."
"I'm blowing off steam," Damon growled back, hurting.
"Fulfill the duty you must perform for us."
"All right, just stop."
"Find him and secure the prize. Make him perform his assigned task, or if he will not do it, perform it for him."
"All right, damn you," Damon winced. He turned away from the canal. The 2 precentals were rushing him along the towpath. One fired, scorching the air beside Damon with plasma heat, a very near miss. Damon pulled up his guns, firing both.
"What are you doing?"
"Finishing things," Damon replied. He could hear the other squads moving in. Wet. It was going to get bloody wet. "I'll do your job, Gahet," he said, with no respect at all. "Once I'm done here..."